Once again, we're tuned in live to Beyond the Lab with Black women in artificial intelligence. And we are so excited because we have a phenomenal guest with us here today, Ms. Oveta Sampson. She is the Vice President, Head of Design, Machine Learning, and Responsible Artificial Intelligence at Capital One. How are you, Oveta?
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's so great to be here. I hope that we'll have a good conversation together and I can learn more about Black women in AI and hopefully inspire some folks as I go through my own story being in artificial intelligence.
Awesome. I'm sure you will. Some of our members have mentioned you by name, actually, and I let them know that we were going to have this conversation. They were really, really excited about it. So the inspiration has already started. So we are excited about that. But give us some insight into your journey into becoming the Vice President and Head of Design, Machine Learning, and Responsible Artificial Intelligence. One. That's a big title.
I know. It's a lot. And today I'm feeling all of that smoke. So I'm trying to shift my mentality to kind of like talk about origin stories. And I think origin stories are really important. I like to tell mine, not because it's mine, but because it's a non-traditional route into technology and artificial intelligence. I started out, my father had always wanted to be, I think, a computer programmer. He was always into education. But unfortunately, my mom died when I was a young child, when I was 2 years old. And my dad had to leave the military and come and take care of a toddler. And so he ended up having to work at here in Chicago. He worked at the post office and then he went to the Chicago Transit Authority. And so that left him little time to study or go to school. But he did do night school. And I do remember my father being in school as long as I have been in school. And when I was like 9 years old or so, he was taking a computer programming class at night. And I really wanted more time with him, to be quite honest. And so I decided that I wanted to learn computer programming. And he was learning COBOL and Fortran. So I don't recommend that for 9 year olds, but there are some 9 year olds who can handle it. But he taught me out of his textbooks how to program Hello World on my Commodore 64, and I thought that was pretty neat to be able to do that. But I also, at that same time, when I was nine was a seminal year for me. I published my first story about a nonfiction story about a squirrel getting into Mrs. Murray's house. But it was kind of like that year where my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Smith, was like, "You're a really great writer. You should probably go into writing." And so I kind of forgot about computer programming. My elementary school didn't have a technology program. And when I went to high school, I didn't take up computer programming, but I did work on the newspaper. And so that's where I kind of got into design. So I was designing newspapers for print. I was the editorial editor by the time I graduated and then went into journalism. But once I got into writing and journalism, I just never lost my love of numbers. So I've always said that my right brain and my left brain have always been connected because I've always seen people, but also really understood numbers and statistics and things behind the stories we were telling. And growing up on the South Side of Chicago as a young Black child, I also kind of understood I think smokescreen of numbers as well, because a lot of people would describe my neighborhood of the South Side of Chicago as violent and not safe. But I remember anecdotally, I remember, you know, but Billiken parades and picnics and having a really safe home, not only just my mom calling me home when the streetlights came on, but Mrs. Murray and Mrs. Clark and the safe community who wanted my success. And so my reality was different from what I was reading in newspapers about the statistics of young folks like me growing up. And that was at a young age, I really understood about the storytelling aspects of numbers and how your reality can be different than people's perception and how they put into statistics and data. And so I guess I grew up with a healthy dose of skepticism when it came to data, because I would read my morning newspaper and then I would go out into my neighborhood and what they were saying was disconnected, right? And so I got into media because I wanted to right some of those wrongs and I wanted to change the narrative, to be quite honest. I know that journalists are supposed to be objective, but I think I had two jobs, right? One being to report the news and two being to change the perception of poor people, marginalized people, people like myself, because I was a living example of the contradiction that the media had been engaged with, and people weren't, you know, really understanding that. And so a lot of my stories took statistics and narratives and put human faces on them. So I did a lot of stories about expulsion to prison pipelines and criminal and juvenile justice. And I think I was just an activist masquerading as a reporter, but I did a lot of stories on criminal. I was a cop reporter. I was a criminal justice reporter. I was an education reporter. And so those stories and that investigative journalism really kind of brought me back to data, right? And really understanding how data is collected, how it's transformed. You know, one of the things that when I talk about data, I always say an example that when people say 50% of Americans, you know, like milk or something like that, you know, you only have to have surveyed 2,000 people to be able to say that, right? Like, so that's way away from all Americans, right? And so really understanding how statistics are used to create perceptions was kind of like instilled in me. And so when I got into design, you know, I went through school and I had a long career in journalism before I came to design. And when I got into design, I got into it by, I had a long career in journalism, and then I had some personal things that happened. And so I had the chance to kind of reinvent myself. And I decided that I wrote in my journal that I was going to get back into tech and I was going to make epic shit. Like, that's what I wrote. And excuse me for the bluntness there, but that was kind of like my roadmap, right? And I went back to school, got my master's in computer science because I fell into predictive analytics and took a couple classes in predictive analytics and really learned the design program from end to end. And just kind of when I got out of DePaul University and my master's degree, I got a job at IDEO as a lead researcher. And they were just looking to start what they called human-centered AI. And so that's kind of how I got into artificial intelligence and creating and designing products using data and model algorithms and model development.
I love what you said in terms of the perception and how the media can paint a perception. I actually was born in Chicago. The things that I heard about Chicago was different than my reality. So when I'm listening to you, I feel like you're telling my story in a sense. So we were good, you know, but the perception and what how people can manipulate the numbers, as you just said, the study only has to be 2,000 respondents, you know. So as you began to merge your journalistic background and storytelling, you know, with the tech background, what are some things that you discovered when you started to merge that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I discovered is that there was a propensity for people to trust numbers more than people. That there are a lot of people, especially in technology, who have an analyst mindset, I think, and who look at numbers as kind of like truth. And so I have this talk that I do, and it's called Ovetta's 10 Commandments of Mindful AI. And one of the commandments is data is not truth. I think it's really important for people to remember that mental models and points of views are varied and diverse. And two people can look at the same event and come away with different perceptions and understanding of that event. And so when I got into design, you know, I was always bringing a mental model and a point of view that wasn't well known. I mean, there wasn't many people who came from the South Side of Chicago who were doing, you know, artificial intelligence design. There certainly weren't many women, and there certainly weren't people who had the kind of background that I had. So I always felt that was a strength of mine to bring that diversity. But what I saw in technology was this kind of like propensity to put a lot of trust into data and into subsequent uses of that data and machine learning. And I had a very heavy dose of skepticism about data in itself, because I had been a victim of, you know, quote unquote bad data, or I was an anomaly, right? So to speak, when in reality, there were a lot of kids like me who were pretty smart, who had two parents, who lived in a household that was stable, who went to school and achieved. You know, I was the boring data, right? Not and so I was the ignored data. And so when I talk about artificial intelligence and how we get it wrong sometimes, I do talk about the sin of omission. We tend to be driven towards certain data points that reaffirm our own confirmation biases. And so we admit part of the story that really doesn't fit into our narrative. And so I talk a lot about widening the narrative, widening our viewpoint when it comes to data, and really interjecting things like, what if things go wrong, so to speak. There's a natural propensity to, especially in analytics or technology, for optimism, that if we use numbers and math and statistics and we can have predictable outcomes. I mean, that's the whole point of machine learning. There's not a lot of what I call intellectual scrutiny on those processes to see if we're actually doing it correctly, because people have a pattern of modern development that they're like has been honed over, you know, 20, 30 years. And so they're like, well, if we just do this formula, we'll be fine. And now there's a shift in looking at, okay, not only are we having bad data in to have bad data, to have bad machine learning outcomes, but that data is, and I heard this recently when I was on a panel, is traumatized data. There's no way that data is going to be able to be clean enough to not have traumatized outcomes. And for example, recently there was all over the news that it was discovered that there were oxygenation pulse that was taking kind of oxygen levels. A medical sensor that was used in hospitals to take oxygen levels for folks were actually inaccurate for people of color, people with melanin. So they were giving inaccurate oxygen level rates to doctors and nurses. And this was during the height of COVID. So, you know, there was some ranking and prioritizing and triaging. And so African-Americans and Latino Americans, and even some Asian Americans, were being reported to have lower oxygen levels than they actually, or higher oxygen levels than they really did, which in turn affected their care. That's traumatized data sets, right? Because our healthcare has been, it has been in infiltrated and indoctrinated with racism, sexism, and ableism. And so that's a data set, no matter where you start, that's going to have traumatized outcomes because we haven't done the work to decouple our societal ills from the technology and the data that we're using to make people better.
So when it comes to traumatized data, when it comes to confirmation bias, in the storytelling, as well as the design, the data itself, how do we overcome that?
To me, the first step is to acknowledge that there's something wrong. I think it's been a long time for people. I mean, and I used to be in the media, and I would hear people say repeatedly that the media was objective, when we all know that it was objective to one point of view, but it wasn't objective to everybody, right? And so really kind of, it took a while for media companies to really kind of acknowledge their, I mean, it used to be called the force of the state for a reason, right? To acknowledge their complicity in perpetuating and pushing forth white supremacy, right? And when I say white supremacy, I mean the idea of superiority having to be tied to race. And so I think that just acknowledging that there's something off here is a huge hurdle. It 4 or 5 years ago, if you'd acknowledged that there was racism in math, people would have thought that you were crazy, you know, or a racism in data or racism in anything that has to do with calculations, right? But now people are starting to, thanks to some good work from, you know, people like Virginia Eubanks, Catherine O'Neill, Timid, you know, all of these people, you know, the Algorithm Justice League, Joy, thanks to actual science, right? Like Joy's research was actual scientific, right? Pointing out the bias that is in our so-called truth, which is data. It's helping people to make it easier for people to acknowledge that they're starting from a traumatized data set. I think the second way that we can overcome this is once we acknowledge it and make ourselves aware of it, then we start to develop ways to combat it, right? Within the model development process, within the data collection process. So we should not be collecting data blindly. We should be collecting data and doing scrutiny over what's the sin of omission here. So for example, if we're trying to decide whether somebody gets a mortgage or not, and we're looking at their FICO score, then we need to really account for the fact that not everybody has a credit card or not everybody has access to a credit history. So how do we account for alternative ways to understand risk with those individuals rather than putting them in the same or painting them with the same paintbrush as everybody else and being unfair to them, even though by law we're being fair, right? Because we're judging them by the same standard, but we're being inequitable. So there's a difference between being fair and having equity, right? So one of the things we should be able to do once we're made aware of it is to scrutinize all of our current processes to see where we are falling short on the equity bar, right? And then once we scrutinize that, and once we made aware, once we scrutinize that, then we can take action against it, right? And that means looking at our models for equity, not just fairness, but or looking at to mitigate bias, but also designing for bias outcomes. So really saying, okay, bias is almost impossible to eliminate. It's better to mitigate it, but then not closing our blind eye when we create models to say they're perfect. Let's just move on, right? So designing for when they're wrong, I like to say, that's when I enter a room, those are the things that I'm thinking about. What happens when they're wrong? And I've coined a term called human engagement risk, that I think is one of the ways that we can flag some of these, some of the social trauma that ends up in our technology. And right now we do risk for privacy risk, we do cyber risk, we do risk for statistical bad hygiene risk, we do risk for data omission, but we don't do risk for what I call human engagement risk. So like, what are the social harms that can happen when this model outcome is engaged with the population, right? What are the cognitive harms? What are the psychological harms that could come from this model? And looking at that through a human-centered design lens. So that's what I try to do as a human-centered designer in artificial intelligence, is to add another lens that has not been there in a repeatable, scalable way to help us to make better, to have better inputs and variables into our models so that we can have better model outcomes.
Now, you mentioned acknowledge, scrutinize, and action against, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, the greats, you know, with Dr. Joy and Timnit and so many others. And my question to you is, because for me, that brings up the question of diversity. We're going to talk about diversity and when it comes to being prepared and the skills that you need in order to be a part of the AI ecosystem, because diversity needs to be in the room, intellectual diversity, diversity of abilities, gender, etc. And so give us some insight on diversity being in the room, and not just being in the room, because we all can be in the room and sit at the table, but do we have power, authority, and influence in that room? So give us some insight on that, on what a person needs to do in order to be in this ecosystem, but also to be effective and successful.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I think one of the things that I think allows folks to be successful, and this actually has nothing to do with machine learning or AI, and more to do with know thyself. So this is anybody who comes to me, and I'm a professor, I'm a teacher. Anybody who comes to me who wants advice or coaching, the first thing I always say is to know thyself, because if you really don't understand your capabilities, your limitations, your gaps, your deep T, like who you are as a person, your character, all that kind of stuff, all of that will be challenged in this area, because some people fight fair, some people don't, but people are very passionate and very consumed by their work in this area, right? So when model developers are developing models, this is a creative outlet for them. They're developing something that is a part of them, right? And so having to challenge that, you really are going to have to bring what people call the soft skills, but I'm calling the essential skills to bear. And that's really empathy and understanding and communication and judgment and all those good things. And sometimes I do it really well and sometimes I don't, but I think knowing thyself and your, and how you operate is really important to succeed in this space. The second part is knowing what's a win-win for the other folks who you're collaborating with really helps you to succeed as well, because it will help you to communicate to them in ways that will allow them to see a different point of view and not be threatened by it. I think it's really important if you're the diverse person in the room, that you start with understanding what folks are trying to get at, like what is a win for them, and then how that aligns with what you know. And if it's in conflict with that, that's okay too, because that's why you're there, right? Like you're there to provide a diverse perspective. It's just in how you do it. So those are the two. Now, beyond those kind of what I call like fundamental character things, obviously it's really, you have to do what I call intelligent interrogation. So that means you have to know enough about this area to be able to ask really great questions. So that means your technical acumen. I read something new on machine learning every day, even though I have been in this process for over almost a decade now. I still am reading new things because it's a moving, living, breathing industry. What was true about machine learning 10 years ago is no longer true today because it changes. And so, you know, being a forever learner, I think, is really important, and not being afraid to ask folks or to question folks when you don't know something. Like, and I know that can be really difficult for, especially for me as a Black woman, because I've always felt like I had to be the smartest person in the room, right? Or I get kicked out or whatever. But I feel like I've learned that it's much better for me to ask a question of something that I don't know than to pretend that I know it, because sooner or later it's going to come up again, and I'm going to get confused, and it's not going to be good for anybody. So I think those like in being open to learning, learning new things, but really learning on top of a good foundation of who you are, like not letting this industry or this subject matter intimidate who you are as a person and your character, right? Like separate those two. It's okay if you don't know everything in machine learning, but you do bring something to the table that's different and that's necessary, and that can be leveraged in artificial intelligence because of who you are.
So do you believe, you know yourself, there needs to be intelligent interrogation, and it seems like there needs to be a continuous learning. It's not, okay, I learned how to code today and I'll never look at it again. So when someone is doing all of those things, is there anything in addition that you see as crucial in preparing for the future? And I know there are two different questions. How does one prepare for the future of tech? We know things are changing rapidly every day. It's something different. But how do they prepare for that when they've said, okay, check, I know myself, I'm good with that. I do the intelligent interrogation. I'm willing to ask questions if I don't understand. But now I sit in this position, right? I've been in this company for 3 years or whatever. How do I prepare for what's next? Where do they go from there?
Wow, such hard questions. Sometimes I have no idea. Like, I often say that I feel like my journey, I'm kind of like the metal pinball in a pinball machine, that I'm just kind of knocked around and I end up in places, right? And sometimes those places are a win and I get lots of points, and sometimes they're a miss, right? And I have to kind of like recalibrate. I think for me, what has sustained myself and being optimistic about the future and my place in artificial intelligence and machine learning is that I'm passionate about equity, not AI. I ended up in machine learning and AI, but I'm passionate about widening the narrative and equity and bringing diverse perspectives into very closed areas. That's what I'm passionate about. Now, I happen to use machine learning and AI as an instrument for that passion, but my end goal my eye on the prize is really about making technology more equitable. And when I'm looking to the future, I'm looking to democratize machine learning AI. I'm looking to make machine learning AI not the purview of literally 0.01% of America, people with computer science, PhDs in computer science, right? Like that, that's a very small number of people in the world who have a very wide power structure called machine learning. Like my goal is to democratize that and to make it more equitable and make it more accessible so that people can not be intimidated about doing the things that they want to do and leveraging what I call the superpower to do it. And the more that we have people who are passionate about in-game causes like that, the better that machine learning and AI will be. I talk a lot, and you can read a lot of my work is, and I wrote this blog about, you know, good design and characterizing that for future in design. And, you know, good to me, that future isn't PhD candidates working on selling advertising, right? Like it's us working on solving some of these societal ills that are being perpetuated. You know, how can we use machine learning and AI to help bring equity in lending, help bring equity in housing, help bring equity in education, help reduce gun violence, like those kinds of things. And not in the way that is done through the one narrow lens of crime and punishment, right? Like that's how machine learning and AI is being used today. It's being used by the same, you know, power structure to extend their one viewpoint instead of widening the narrative for this technology to be used in different ways. We don't have to use facial recognition just to catch people, right? We can use AI and machine learning to help bring equity and justice to people. But because people who have that passion aren't using these technologies, we just get these technologies to be used in one funnel way by the current power structure, right? So how do we use technology and leverage technology with different end games in mind? People who have different passions and causes that they want to use this technology to advance.
So your passion is guiding you in terms of the future of tech.
Yeah. So it decides it's the one thing I consult when I'm deciding where I want to work, what I want to do, what is important to me, that kind of thing. And so, where I leverage my energy, right? That's really important. You can't do everything. And so you have to rank and prioritize. And so that is my compass of where I go to decide, to make decisions. And I think it's really important when diverse talent gets into this industry that they're really guided by something else than money, where they want to work, being a part of FANG or having, you know, a technical background or whatever. Like we have a higher calling than that, right? And so I encourage people who get into this industry to learn all they can and really put and leverage this technology for the causes that are really near and dear to them. That's what startups are doing. Like that's what entrepreneurs are doing. It's just that their causes aren't aligned with mine. Right. So, whoever, Mark Zuckerberg had a passion, right. But that doesn't mean that he's the only one who can use these types of technologies to advance their passion. So my goal is to widen the door, right. Let more diverse perspectives in as much as possible. But to do that, I have to get in the door, really understand how it works, and then help teach other people how it works. And then hopefully those folks will use it to further their own passion.
So you're utilizing your skills, your gifts, your talents, and your passion at Capital One give us some insight in terms of Capital One and how they're preparing their employees, how you guys are preparing your employees for the next 5 years of innovation.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, Capital One CEO Rich, he talks a lot about crossing the canyon, right? And, you know, our first phase was going into the cloud. And that was a canyon that, you know, we as a bank decided was something we felt was needed to be able to serve our customers in the future. That's kind of the first step. And I'm a part of the second step is once we get in the cloud, how do we make it easier for everyone to do everything, right? That's what machine learning and AI is really all about, like automating and making things, augmenting human work and labor with automation and machines to help us to do things better, faster, quicker. And so we're right in the midst of that, like preparing and building those tools and platforms for our internal associates to do their jobs better, but also for our associates who are customer facing and in their interaction with our customers. And so it's a phased approach, right? But it's always looking ahead to where we want to be. And, you know, building up an enterprise machine learning team is super important to in that beginning phase. We're crossing another canyon, and that's machine learning and artificial intelligence throughout Capital One. And, you know, upskilling our associates in that and collaborating across teams, like all of that is happening right now.
Real time. I love that.
In real time. It's a lot.
We've been talking a lot about tech and artificial intelligence, of course, but, you know, I want to know, with all of the things that are happening, how do you create balance beyond the lab, beyond your work environment? How important is that?
Yeah, I think it's really important. Again, it goes back to know thyself. And this is a real reflective moment for me because I'm right in the midst of kind of like trying to reclaim my passion again. And there's a lot of work that I'm doing that's a little bit overwhelming. And so I'm just trying to get back to my, you know, my center. And one of the things that is helping me to do that is to really focus my energy outside of work on things that bring me joy. You know, I'm a caretaker for my mom and I work a lot and, and so I've kind of been overwhelmed with a lot of responsibilities, you know, just, you know, moving and all kinds of different things. And so what I've been trying to do weekly is to, you know, really concentrate energy in a routine on things that give me joy. And one of the things that gives me the most joy, and I did it this morning, is going swimming. And it allows me to kind of like just release all of whatever was going on, and whatever comes to me during the day just seems to not be as intense after I swim. So, you know, taking walks in my neighborhood, you know, yesterday I had a whole series of meetings and I took half of them walking 2 miles to the Starbucks in my neighborhood and back. So just really being intentional, right? Just as intentional as I am in work, intentional about preserving time for me to be centered and doing things that bring me joy.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You have to have that balance. You know, mental health is physical health, all of that well-being is extremely important. And one final question I have to ask, and I hope you're ready for this question. What is on your playlist?
Oh, yeah, that is great. I just downloaded Kendrick Lamar's new album. So I've been like repeatedly listening to that. Somebody told me about it on Facebook and he just raved about it. And I was like, well, it can't be that great. But I, you know, recently downloaded. And then I have what's called a Saturday playlist. And so it's a playlist that I play every Saturday morning. And because that's when I usually do like my cleaning and laundry and all that kind of stuff after I go swim. And it is kind of like the 90s revisited. So all of my hip hop, like I'm just a hip hop head and a house head. So it's like hip hop and house and just a little bit of like Nina Simone and Tina Turner, like some My Daddy's Basement stuff. Like it's all the things that bring me joy. And so it's like, you know, Mary J. Blige and it's like, you know, Dr. Dre and it's like Eminem and it's like Nina Simone and some way back stuff, all mixed in that, some house music all mixed in to just kind of like for 2 hours of amazing music listening. And I think my Saturday playlist is pretty much like who I am as a person.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I want to thank you guys so much for being here, a part of Beyond the Lab with Black Women in Artificial Intelligence. We certainly look forward to speaking with you soon. Is there anything that you want to leave our audience with, whether it's any announcements in regards to Capital One, if you're recruiting or anything of that nature, or just the message in general that you want to leave with our audience?
Yeah, I just want to say like that don't be afraid to get into the space. Capital One has many avenues to be able to begin in technology. There are a whole spectrum of things from engineering to design. Like, you know, you don't have to start at the top here. And I think being open to learning and self-motivating and learning how to do things will help you to succeed. And lastly, just really know thyself, really kind of let your passion guide you into where you think you want to leverage the best of this technology to fulfill what you feel is really important, to know your end game. And that to me is the most important thing.
Thank you so much for being a part of Beyond the Lab with Black Women in Artificial Intelligence.
Thanks for the invite.
Thank you so much. Once again, you're tuned in live to Beyond the Lab with Black Women in Artificial Intelligence. We just had a wonderful conversation with Ms. Ovetta Sampson. She is the Vice President, Head of Design, Machine Learning, and Responsible Artificial Intelligence at Capital One. Thanks again, and we'll certainly speak with you soon on the other side of the microphone. Have a good night.